This interview with Mario Demby was recorded on April 21st, 2021, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
I was in jail for selling drugs, distribution. Absolutely. I definitely learned my lesson. I actually caught a charge when I was in there as well. When I first got incarcerated, I got sentenced to 5 years. But I was selling drugs on the inside, and I caught an additional 7 years. So I ended up doing a total of 10 and a half years altogether. So I definitely learned my lesson. Absolutely. I mean, it was a lot of stress with that, because it was kind of hard. Like, when it was time for my release date from the 5 years of being released, I had to, like, tell my mom, you know, my son and everybody, you know, that I was going to be sitting for an additional 7 years. So it was kind of hard to explain that to them. So it kind of hurt me more, you know, it hurt me more hurting them than actually myself. I would say it's not hard. It's all about what you want. It's not hard. Like, a lot of guys say that it's hard to get a job when you come home, but it's not. I came home, got my CDLs, and I was very successful when I came home, you know, so it's not hard at all. It's all about what you want. Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, I guess it depends on the individual. You know, it depends on the individual. And if you're ambitious enough to do that, you're going to get it done. So it depends on the individual and what you want out of life. Absolutely. Absolutely. I had a lot of time to think, a lot of time to plan things, you know, and, you know, do what I was supposed to do when I got out. Then I promised family that I wouldn't go back either. So I was like, I would never, ever sell a drug again. You know, and I haven't done that since I've been home. I've been home 5 years, 5.5 years, actually. When I first got released,
yes, sir.
I mean, I was kind of nervous. I was nervous at first. I had like butterflies when I first came home, because, you know, things change over the years. You know, so I was kind of nervous. I didn't even come outside for the first 8 months of being released. I would work and come home, so it was all about family. I didn't want to go outside. I didn't want to do nothing. I didn't want to be around like homeboys, you know, or old associates, or none of that. All I wanted to do was be around family. I was very disappointed in myself, but I actually needed that. I think I needed that, because if I had went home, you know, by doing the 5 years that I had, did that, I had the same intentions to come home and do the same thing. So I'm kind of glad that happened, because it changed my whole mindset. It changed everything. I mean, it's just like, after being locked up for a numerous amount of years, it's just like it's a feeling that you have. It's like unexplainable. If you haven't actually experienced it, it's kind of hard to, like, you have to actually experience that, and, you know what I'm saying, in order to know what I'm talking about. You know, but it's like you just have that feeling. It's just a feeling of being nervous. Like, not a threat, but it's just like you're back into society. And, you know, you're back out there in the world, and it's just like a nervous feeling. It's just a feeling. For me, it wasn't difficult. The only problem I had is, like, when I came home, I was still taking showers with my boxers on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was still doing that. So I guess that's the only problem that I really had. Like, when I came home, it took me a while. Like, my wife would tell me, like, you're home now. You don't have to do that. Nah, actually not, because I used to see guys come. I used to see guys, like, go home and come back within, like, 30 days, 90 days. I'm like, you didn't want to, like, why didn't you want to stay home? Like, what's wrong?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? What happened? It's hard out there. It's hard out there. I'm like, man, it's not hard out there. It's all about what you want. If you want it, you can accomplish it. It's all about what you want. Oh, yeah, like, when you're in the chow hall, I mean, you eating. You know, they rushing you out. You know, as soon as you sit down, they rushing you out, you know. So when you come home, I mean, I came home and they had a party for me, you know. So I'm eating at the table. So I'm eating faster than everybody else. So everybody else looking at me like, what's wrong with him?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I picked up that habit. And as far as, like, staying to yourself and, you know, like, staying to yourself and learning not to get involved with others, you know, because, like, when you're in prison, you're in a closed environment, you know, so you can't run nowhere. It's not like out here, you know, so if you get involved with anything, you know, if you get involved in any type of altercations, you can't run with it, so you got to deal with it. I mean, I had one fight. when I was up Hagerstown, and I caught my cell buddy masturbating. My cell buddy was masturbating, you know, and I beat him up, you know. So that's the only altercation I had. But once I set that tone, I didn't have any more problems. You know, that was it. He was older than me, and I was only like 28 at the time, you know. So like in Hagerstown, like the police up there, they're like very racist. If you walk on the grass, they might call you a, they might call you out your name. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's, you have to stay off the grass in Hagerstown. So you're walking on, you know, they don't, you can't walk on the grass, but it's like different prisons have different rules. Like anywhere in the city, if you're in the prisons in the city, it's different because it's ran by mostly African Americans. So everything's ran differently. So each prison has different, you know, it's like different standards in you know, each institution. How did I keep my sanity? I mean, I read a lot. Read a lot, did a lot of writing, and stayed on the phone. I actually had a cell phone when I was in there because I was like I said, I was involved with heavy drug activity. So I had privileges that other people didn't have. So other people was like out there trying to like fighting over the phone. I'm in my cell with my cell phone, you know. So then you got correction officers bringing that in, you know. That's why I said different, you know. That's how it is, you know. When I first went in, I mean, I was hurt, you know, because I left my family behind, and it's like hurtful because like when you're in prison, the first thing you think of is somebody dying, you know. You're like, you know, somebody died when you're in prison, you know. You definitely don't want that to happen. So I was lucky enough, you know, everybody was still alive when I came home. I mean, my grandmother passed when I got home. She was sick, but I actually made it home to a funeral. So nobody actually died while I was incarcerated. The Mario then was all about himself, selfish, self-centered, didn't care about nothing but himself, you know, what he could get or what he could do. And the Mario now is a family man. Lovable, caring, knowledgeable, you know, filled with a lot of wisdom and a lot of love. And, you know, I pretty much try to pass that to, you know, the youth out here as well. I try to, you know, try to teach them and show them the ropes as well, you know, because we live in a treacherous city. Because I grew up in a church, you know, I grew up in a church family. So I always had that installed with, but my dad died when I was 12 years old. So that's pretty much like when everything went left, you know. So, because I actually been a juvenile, I've been to Charles Dickey Junior School and all of that too, before prison, you know. So I did the little group homes and all of that, you know. So I've been through a lot in my life. I've been through a lot and learned a lot. That's right. I could have came home, got killed, anything, because I had the same intentions. I had the same intentions to come home to do the same thing that got me in there. So I'm glad. I said it was a blessing. It was a blessing from God that I, you know, that I got caught in there selling drugs, because it changed my whole outlook on life. It saved my life. Actually, it saved my life. Yeah, somebody told on me they couldn't oppress us. We had a little clique. It was like 10 of us, and nobody couldn't oppress us, you know. So they told the police on us, and they caught us bagging it up red handed. Yeah. I ain't gonna lie, at that time, Mr. Stovall, I didn't even care. I'm not even gonna lie, I was like cold-hearted in there, so I didn't care until I actually got into doing that 7 years, and when I had to break it down to my mom that I wasn't, my mom and my son and my family, that I wasn't coming home when I was supposed to be coming home, that's when it hurt. That's when it actually set in. Yeah, I did lockup time. I went on lockup for like, I did 180 days on lockup. I did 6 months. I stabbed the guy and caught 100. Yeah, I caught 6. He told on me, and I stabbed him. He told on me, and I caught 180 days. Yeah, I read a lot of books, but I exercised a lot too. So it was like, it went fast, actually. Then I had people like looking out for me on, you know, when I was on solitary. So it was like I had a radio when I wasn't supposed to have one. I had commissary. So it was like I was okay. I was living like a king. So it didn't even bother me at that time. Oh, she was very supportive. She was there almost every visit, you know, pictures and, you know, the love, Like, it was there. Like, you know, it was perfect. She was there for every visit. Like, commissary money. Like, I never had to worry about nothing. Money on the phone. Right. I mean, it makes you feel very important. I mean, very important. And because I used to see a lot of guys in there, like, especially guys, I mean, they used to, like, you had guys calling home to their girlfriend, especially in the summertime. Like, guys used to call home, and their girls is doing, you know, I mean, who knows what. You know, one guy tried to rip the phone off the wall because his girl didn't answer the phone, you know. So, absolutely. Because, like, now, it's just different now. You know, so I wouldn't advise, and I thank God that my son is the total opposite of how I was. You know, like, he's the total opposite. So I'm glad that he didn't have to experience what I had to experience. You know, and for the youth now, it's like, the youth now, they don't have any, you know, they don't have no leadership. They don't have any role models. That's why when I see them out here in the streets, I try to pull them up and I talk to them, try to motivate them. But, you know, they still have their own mind. They still have their own way of life, where they still going to make their own decisions, you know, but I still try to guide them in the right direction.
one day. And I told him that a group of us would like to start a program in the course while we're here to talk to the first time youth offenders that's coming here. Because, like I said, I was nervous, I was scared. People was tricking you when you went in there. People was raping you and molesting you and things of that nature. And this stuff was still going on. And I explained that to the warden that, these guys coming here with nothing, and they asked to bar things, not understanding, the rules and regulations of this different world, of being in a different world other than being outside in another world, and a lot of times they would fall in the trap. So they allow us to start, this Youth Act program while we was in there. I started a new job. Once I got out of that, I went into this other job called MCI program. It's like where you make the most money in the program, but we was printing up license stickers, yearly stickers and stuff like that to go on to cars and stuff like that for motor vehicle, they were getting contracts. So we was doing that. And I learned to do that. One of the things I learned is how to run a printing press. It's called the ABJ printing press and stuff like that. So I learned to do that with that. You have to choose and decide what you want to do with your time. You have to sit back and ask yourself, do you want to further go down the rabbit hole, or do you want to change, your way of life, And it's real hard to do that because I say, like, you're in a different world and there's so much going on around you and your mentality change, while you're there. So I made the choice, to try to say, I'm going to do something with my life because I don't even know if I'm going to make it home or not with a 50-year sentence. It's like having a life bit. It makes you feel good. It's more than making you feel good because first, let me get back to this. And I don't want to be redundant. I'm Muslim, and it gives you a different perspective on how to look at life, and how to look at another human being, whether you're Muslim, Jew, Christian, whatever, atheist, whatever. It gives you a different perspective to look at life and how to respect it, So what you say, you have to be that. You couldn't just say something to somebody in there and not allow it to be your character. So it made me feel good that the things that I was saying to the guys that was coming in, that some of them was older than me, some of them wasn't older than me. It made me feel good to say the things that I was saying to them because I had to be what I was saying. My model had to be that inside of the jail. When we stepped out of this room and going back into, the jail system, you have to be that. And them guys looked at you real close, and they draw closer to you because they felt a sense of protection that everybody looked for when you go in there. Even the strongest guys, like when I talk about Little Melvin, Sim Charles, Steakham and stuff like that, even the guys from The Wire, they're my closest friends, Chris Warren and all of them, Bodie, all of them, they're my closest friends. These are guys I come up with. Even us, we cry. We feel a sense of abandonment. We feel like, we left alone and there's nobody there for us. So you have to, pull yourself together and you have to make a serious decision. Now, I didn't make this decision when I first went in there. I still had a street mentality. It was kill or be killed. Do what you had to do. You have to be there first, to find out, how do I deal with this world in here? How do I deal with all these ills that I heard about what's going on in here? You know what I mean? And again, I seen guys trick dudes out of their butt. I seen dudes trick, and some of them was the best of friends. I even seen a dude, I heard a dude, and he was talking about paying off his bill. He said he had another court to go through, and he had already had a 30-year sentence. It was a white guy, and he said he don't think he can handle another, some more time. And it was a commissary day, and everybody was going up to the chow when he was coming back from commissary. He said, I'm going to pay all y'all off that I owe y'all. He said, y'all can take this right here. He said, the rest of y'all, when y'all come back, it'll be in my cell. Now, his cell was next door to me. And again, I worked in an MCI shop. So that's the best job you can get in the system. I came down to go to commissary just to put my stuff in my cell and then go back to work. So I didn't go to chow that day. So I heard something, and I had made my salat because my prayer came in. But I heard something kicking on the wall real hard, kicking on the wall real, real hard and stuff. I knocked on the wall, right? And I said, boy, you all right over there? And it wouldn't, never said nothing. So when they came back from chow, he had hung himself. He had hung himself. You open up all the doors when you come back from chow, but you got to get in your cell. And I stepped out there to look at him and make sure he was all right. But he had hung himself, you know, and it messed me up real bad, you know, because that wasn't the first hanging I saw, but he was actually a good dude, you know. I mean, we made mistakes, stuff like that, you know, but he was actually a good dude. You know, that wasn't the only hanging I saw. I saw a lot, you know, being in prison for 30 years, you see a lot. I'm going to give you two, and I'm going to try to make it as brief as possible. I'm gonna give you two of the experiences that I saw. Well, I'm gonna give you three, and I'm gonna make them real brief. Young guy, younger than me at the time, I had grown a little older then. I probably was in my mid-20s, maybe late 20s, was on the phone talking to his young lady, telling her that, you know, don't leave, hold on. You know, I got a kid, but you say I'm going back to court, he said. And the judge talking about taking most of my time back. That mean I would only have to do a year. You can hear him because he's talking real loud. And at this time, they had put phones on the tears. And he was talking real loud and stuff like that. And he was like, don't leave me. And started crying and stuff like that. And the officer, you know, told him he had to hold it down because he was loud and talking to his girl. So she must have hung up on him because he kept saying, you dead. And he tried to call back, and she wouldn't accept the call. He asked the officer to let him lock in and stuff. And he went and locked in. And about a half an hour, maybe to an hour later, you know, the tier he was on was a traffic tier. And what that means, you had to come through his tier to get to other tiers, you know. And one of his friends was coming up this through the tier to go to his cell. Looked in his cell, and he had hung himself. He was hanging from the bars, and when the officer opened up the grill, everybody ran down to his cell, you know, and they were telling the officer, open the door so we can grab him and try to put him up to see if he was still living. Mm-hmm. But the officer, you can't do that. You got to leave the scene exactly the way it is, you know. And the officer wouldn't open the door. He wouldn't even go in there and do it until the warden came up and nurses from the infirmary came up. So we felt that sense of betrayal, knowing that the system didn't have our best interests at heart. When gangs started getting popular in the jail, this guy, he, you know, his family was real supportive of him. So, and we get packages. We had package months and all that type of stuff, you know. And this guy, he would take certain guys and say, go, let me get a package in your name. That wasn't getting packaged. He said, I'll get my mother to buy you a couple pair of jeans, and I'll get my mother to buy you some tennis, you know, because he wanted to get it, you know, have a lot of clothes. Mm-hmm. So this particular dude, I knew the dude too, come out of Lexington Terrace. You know, he was in the game, Black Gorilla, whatever they call him. What's the name?
Family.
Exactly.
BFG, Black Gorilla Family.
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they went to him to lean on him and tell him to go get us some of this. And he told me, he said, man, you must be crazy. I'm not getting you anything. He said, all right. So I'm not, you know, scared of that. So we went in the yard that evening. And in jail, you can tell when something can happen because you feel that all around you, so you know it. You know, you feel that vibe going around you, and everybody back is to the wall. You know, so I walk out in the yard, and one of the guys say, you know, I used to like to run the yard. He used to say, Basim, hold on, man. He said, something great happened. And lo and behold, before I can turn around, you can hear a bat cracking. The dude hit the dude with the bat in the head and cracked his skull. Mm-hmm. He died. He died. They sent in an ambulance to lift him up out of there, but the guy died. We had to go in this place called the Annex. So they moved a lot of us off the tier because off of certain tiers because asbestos was all through the tier and the fungus and stuff was falling up the wall. So while they was working on it and closed down the tier, they sent us in this place called the Annex. It's like a dorm. Mm-hmm. You got three parts to this dorm. You know, so we had one tier in this dorm, one tier in that dorm, one tier. And you can interact with each other and stuff like that. This guy that I know that come out of Murphy Holmes, and another guy that came out of another part of Murphy Holmes, was there. And the older guy, and the guy was real small. He was leaning on the younger guy. He was always take his commissary, always go through his packets and stuff like that. And the younger guy would always report to the officers what the guy was doing. And he wanted to be moved from the tier or moved out of jail. And they would just discount it and throw it away and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So when they moved us down in the annex and they had a gym period and a guy told him, and it was a commissary day, and he told me, he said, when I come back, excuse my language, he said, my commissary shit better be on my bed. The young guy said, I'm tired of this, man. I'm not going to allow you to do this to me anymore. This is the last time. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing it. So on the way, when they came back from gym, we get like an hour and maybe 20 minutes to a half an hour in gym. You know, when they came back from gym, he come in there. He called himself being bad. He walked straight to the young guy. And the young guy pulled out an ice pick and stuck him right in his chest. And he left it in his chest. And the dude grabbed his chest and turned around. And what you call, what we got, where officers sit up in the station, we call it the bubble. He tried to walk to the bubble, and before he got to the bubble, he fell. And that's where he died. You know, so, you know, a lot of stuff in prison, yeah, you see. And psychologically, yes, infection. And you have to mold your life around that because you don't never know when it's going to be someone to challenge you. One thing my mother told me when she put me out, right, she used to always, you know, still be there for me, but she told me, don't you ever think you bad because of someone badder than you. And they will always challenge you because they want to be the most bad one. She said, but always be serious and a man of your word. And I stuck with that. It stuck with me to the day. I'm a serious brother. And I take things real serious. And I try to be a man of my word. And if things change, I go to the person and say, look, I have to do something else. This is what's happening. Now, can you bear with me? Or let's just, you know, resolve the issue. You know, and I remember that. And it makes me a better man. Having a strike against you, you know, it always fall in a place where opportunities are lacking, and you're not, you know, given the, you know, the best of the choices that come a person's way. What you have to realize that you put yourself in this position, and you have to make something happen for yourself. You know, society, to me, in a lot of ways, haven't gotten better. It got some ways worse than it was when I went in society because, you know, you did, like, you know, Brother Greg said, you had a moral compass out here on the streets when I went in. You know, men would be men, and they would stick, you know, they lived it by principles and standards and stuff like that. You know, today, youth doesn't live by certain standards or morals and stuff like that. Even when you go into going into a company or a corporation and trying to get a job. You know, when I first came home, I went to this welding company and my credentials was better than the guy that was before me and after me. And when I went into an interview, she asked me, was I ever incarcerated? I started to lie because I know is a window that you have from 5 to 7 years that they can ask you about your incarceration or put on your application. And I didn't put it on there. And when she went down the application, she asked me, you know, was you ever incarcerated? And I paused. And I was asking myself in my mind, you know, should I tell her the truth or should I lie? You know, and I said, I'm going to tell her the truth because this would be the best way of me getting something, you know, with my belief in God and everything and stuff like that. So I told her, I said, yes, I was incarcerated before. I said, but it'd been a long time ago. It was a while ago. I said, it was back in 1985. I said, I haven't been to prison since then. And then she said, would you mind expounding on what you was incarcerated for? And it kind of, I kind of knew then, right then and there, that I was going to be a scratch from this list, right? And I told her, I said, is that a requirement? Do I have to do it? She said, no, you don't have to do it. She said, but I would prefer you do it. Okay, I told her, I said, okay, well, I was young. I said, I come out of a drug-ridden area. Some of us would call it probably ghetto and things of that nature. I say, but it was, an area where you grew up and you had to make certain choices. I said, when I was young, I made the wrong choice. I said, I got in a situation where some guys kind of tried to rob me and I had a gun on me. And I shot one of the guys and he died. And she said, all right, I don't need to hear no more. But I knew right then and there that society wasn't going to play fair with me, you know, and that I would have to make my own way. But I had to understand, too, on the other side of that coin, no one did this to me but me, you know. So I had to find somewhere to keep trying to put this bitterness that I had with society about me being in incarceration in a place where it wouldn't affect me of doing what I needed to be done, you know. So, yeah, no. I think society plays for it. And sometimes it does. Yes, I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Anna. And you know, it was a blessing to me. You know, and just to piggyback from what you said, right, in terms of strength, a lot of people say to me, right, Pasin, that's my Muslim man. They say, Pasin, tell me the truth. You did 30 years straight. I say, yeah. I say, man, you're not demented. You're not crazy. Nothing like that stuff. I said, I'm blessed by God. I say, so if you call that crazy, then I'm crazy. I said, but no, I'm not crazy. Do I have my moments of psychological effects? I said, yeah, I had them. I said, but everybody has them. You know, I said, but I'm not crazy. I trusted God while I was there, and God brought me through. But when I went to prison, you know, I had a prison experience where I went to a Christian meeting and they was talking about other religious groups on how, you know, if you don't accept Christ, you're going to hell, and you and they this and they that, you know, some of them are nationalists and all. Now I said to them, this is before I caught my 50-year sentence. I say, why is we talking about other groups? Let's talk about what God can do for us. Because I'm scared, because I went in there, my papers, they give you a true bill when you have a murder. Had first degree on there, murder. You don't get the rest of the degrees until you go into court, you know, like first degree, second degree manslaughter, something like that, or not guilty. You know, so I said, why does we keep talking about these people? Let's talk about what God going to do for us and what we need to do to change. I don't want to hear that in the outside coordinating them. And I hear the group say, well, if you don't want to hear this, you can leave, right? And I left. And I had already knew two older guys that was in Islam. Asked me, well, I thought you was at your meeting. I said, nah, I just went through something, you know, stuff like that. So they said, well, you're welcome to come to a Talim service, which is a speaking gathering when you go to the Muslim thing. And it made me open my heart to look at other religions. And I seen Islam, I found Islam was the best thing for me. You know, it opened my mind. You know, it gave me a different perspective about people and the world, you know. And it just went from there, you know, just went from there. But I try not to push it on other people, because they are who they are, regardless of what it is. You know, I just, you know, leave it to me. And when somebody asks me, then I explain it to them. I would love to do this again whenever you need me. I would love to give back because there's so much to what I have to say in terms of me, that transition from being my first incarceration into my second, you know, and yes. the things that affected me in terms of my second incarceration. So I would love to do this again because I feel like I'm giving back.